Yesterday, being a part of the Elevate Leadership Conference, which was held in Nashville and sponsored by the Sycamore Congregation in Cookeville, and had just a wonderful day with a number of friends and leaders in the church. And I would encourage different folks who are in different positions of leadership at Graymere to think about being a part of that next year. I'm excited to be a part of what we are today, and I pray that the things we look at today will challenge us to look into our hearts and our lives and change the way we think and live. Maybe you've heard the story about a young man who worked at a grocery store. Lady came into the produce department, and this particular story, she comes up to him and says, "Young man, I'd like a half a head of lettuce." Kind of has a puzzled look and says, "Did you say a half a head of lettuce?" She says, "Yes, I want a half a head of lettuce." "Ma'am, we only sell them as whole heads. We don't sell them as a half a head of lettuce." "Well, I want a half a head of lettuce." "And you mean to tell me after all of these years that I've shopped at this store, all the money that I've spent at this store, you won't let me have a half a head of lettuce?" Says, "Ma'am, just give me a minute. Let me go talk to the manager." So he comes walking up to the manager and says, "Sir, there is a problem over in produce." "Really? What's the problem?" "Some crazy lady over there wants just a half a head of lettuce." Now the young man notices that while he's talking about this, that the manager starts doing this number, you know, where you're kind of trying to point with your head, and suddenly it dawns on the young man that the manager is trying to tell him that the lady from produce has followed him over there and is standing right behind him. And so without batting an eye, he turns around and says, this kind and wonderful lady would like to buy the other half." Well, later on, the manager, they're back in the break room, and the manager goes up to the young employee and says, "I just want you to know how impressed I was and how quickly you can think on your feet. Where in the world did you learn to think that quickly?" He says, "Well, you know, I grew up in Grand Rapids. I'm used to dealing with folks like that. In fact, everybody knows if you grew up in Grand Rapids, the only thing they have there are great hockey teams and ugly women." Well, then the manager gets this angry look on his face and he says, "My wife is from Grand Rapids." So the young man says, "Well, which hockey team does she play for?" Now, as you think about that extremely poor attempt at humor this morning, I want you to think about the tongue, because that's what today's lesson is about. I want you to think about how often we say thoughtless things without considering the damage that can be done by those simple words. And many times it's not a joke, it's not a laughing matter, and it's not quickly or easily, or sometimes it can never be undone, whether it's by a witty saying or a well thought out one. So with that in mind, I want us to focus our attention today on Psalm 52. Remember last week we talked about that we were going to look at some of the circumstantial psalms, some of the psalms that tie into circumstances and events in the life of David. We've looked at about three circumstantial psalms from the life of David. Last week, we looked at Psalm 59, and we talked about the aftermath of the attempt by Saul to execute David, how he sent his men to surround David's house. We're going to move to Psalm 52 because it's the next psalm chronologically that fits into what's going on in David's life. And what we're going to find is that he continues to have to face foe after foe after foe. And what I want us to see over time is the consistent faith and trust that David has no matter what he faces. And remember we talked about last week that as we read these psalms that potentially come out of circumstances in his life, that it's kind of like reading David's daily journal or his diary. It's his commenting on what is found written in the text. Now, when we look at the psalm in just a few moments, we're going to focus on power. I want us to think about the power of the tongue, the power of trust, and the power of thanks. But before we look at the specifics of the psalm, I think we need to take several moments and look at the situation that lies behind it. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to start out looking at the situation, look at the events that led to the writing of the psalm, and then we'll hit some of the highlights of the psalm, and this lesson will be yours. As we look at the background, you might want to turn in your Bibles over to 1 Samuel chapter 18 or 19. Actually, 19 is where we started last week. 19 through 22 is kind of the area that we're going to be covering. Try to put up on the screen for you the introduction as well as a brief hint of what we looked at last week. If you look at the introduction in Psalm 52, it gives you some of the general introductory stuff, who it's written for, etc. It refers to it as a maskil, a maskil. You'll find, I think, about 13 of the Psalms, somewhere thereabout, have this in an introduction. It basically has the idea of teaching or instructing or making someone to understand. And so some say that it's a word used for these are somehow supposed to be instructional Psalms. But specifically, notice the circumstances. It says, of David, when Doeg the Edomite came and told Saul and said to him, David has come to the house. Now, as we talk about that, I want us to now go back to 1 Samuel chapter 19 and just kind of walk through what's going on in the life of David. If we go to 1 Samuel 19, remember that David is being sought by Saul. Saul has sent his men to surround David's house. Michal, who is David's wife and King Saul's daughter, hears about the plot to kill her husband. She knows what her father's like. She loves David. And so what she does is she warns David about the trap. And David sneaks away. And the text tells us, if we follow this through 1 Samuel, it says that he goes from Gibeah, which is where he was when attacked by Saul. He travels from there to Ramah, and to actually a small section of Ramah, which seems to be inhabited by the prophets. And when he gets there, he goes to see Samuel. Because you'll remember, if you go back to 1 Samuel 16, Samuel was the one who came to his home and anointed him as the next king in secret. So Samuel has told him he's going to be king. And so as he thought he was going to be king, now he's running for his life from the existing king. And so my guess is he goes to Samuel for advice, saying, hey, you said this was going to happen. This is what's happening. What do I do next? After he talks to Samuel, it seems that Saul tries to follow him, and God thwarts that attempt by actually seeming to cause Saul to prophesy. When he comes to the area of the prophets and he's trying to look for Saul, God's Spirit overwhelms him and prevents him from being able to take David. In the meantime, David is going to come back somewhere in the region of Gibeah, and chapter 20, verse 1 tells us, and he's going to meet with his friend Jonathan, who is Saul's son. And again, I think it's interesting that two of the allies who played the biggest role in helping David were two of the children of King Saul. They knew their father, they knew David, and they recognized and valued, apparently, the integrity of David over their father. And so you have, basically, that chapter is dealing with David and Jonathan. David is saying, basically, what did I do to your father? Why is he doing this? Jonathan said, my dad tells me everything. If he's going to try to kill you, I know he'll tell me. And so basically what he does is he's going to go get information. He's then going to get a secret signal to David. And when he talks to his dad, he finds out that his dad does intend to kill David. He passes that information on to David, and then you have this final parting between David and Jonathan in which they make a covenant. Jonathan has resigned himself to the fact that his friend David is going to be king. And so he asks David, he says, basically, when you become king, don't kill me. And when you become king, take care of my children, basically, if I'm not here. And so you have this final tearful parting. When they leave there, they then go to where the tabernacle is at Nob. The tabernacle had been at Shiloh during the days when Eli was the high priest. Remember Samuel, the same Samuel who anointed David as king, the same Samuel who David went to see at Ramah. He grew up at the tabernacle at Shiloh when Eli was the high priest. But apparently when he passed away or somewhere thereabout, the tabernacle was moved and most of the furnishings seemed to have gone with it, though potentially maybe not everything. And so you have Ahimelech, who is now the high priest. And so what David does is he goes to see him at Nob. Now, as he comes there, he comes by himself. And the priest is scared. He doesn't understand what's happening. The text says he is trembling. David comes by himself. He knows that David is an important commander in Saul's army. But evidently, when he's seen David in the past, and David apparently has come there on other occasions, and the reason, apparently, that David came, based on what's going to be talked about in chapter 22, is that he came to inquire of the Lord. He came to the tabernacle. In other words, he's gone to get advice from Samuel. Now he's going to get advice from God Himself. And so that's why he's at the tabernacle. But apparently, when he came at other times, he wasn't always by himself. And so the fact that he came by himself without any of his soldiers, without any entourage, it caused the priest to wonder what was going on. And so what happens is, basically, David lies to him to protect him, to make sure he doesn't have information, so he doesn't compromise him, to try to save his life. It ends up being a futile attempt. And he basically says, I'm on a secret mission from Saul, and my men are stationed just out of the way, and I'm going back to see them. And by the way, we need something to eat. Do you have anything to eat? And he says, no, all we have are these 12 loaves of consecrated bread that are on the table of showbread in the tabernacle that are devoted to God. And what they would do is these symbolize the 12 tribes of Israel and God's provision for Israel. And so every Sabbath they would put 12 fresh new loaves, and the old loaves were eaten by the priests. He says, that's all I've got that you and your men can eat. But he says, I'll let you have that if your men are in a ritualistic or in a ceremonially clean state. And so basically what happens there is that he assures him that that is in fact the case. He says, my men are ceremonially clean. And so he gives him the bread. And then David goes on to say, do you have any weapons here? And ironically, he says, well, the only weapon we have here is we have the sword of Goliath here. Now, it wasn't terribly uncommon in the ancient world when one king defeated another king to maybe take some of the spoils of battle and put it in the temple of their god. Okay, and so it shouldn't be surprising at all that after David defeats Goliath, they take his sword, which is the symbol of his power, and present it in the tabernacle of the God who David said won the victory. Remember when David fought Goliath, he said, I don't fight in my own power, I fight in the power of the God of Israel, that you may know there is a God in Israel, and He gives me the victory. And so because God gave him the victory, he gave God the sword. But now he's in dire need. He doesn't have a weapon, and that's the only one available. And he says, I'll take it, for there's none like it. So basically what he's doing is he's getting advice, he is getting supplies, getting food and a weapon because he's on the run for his life. Remember, he had to sneak out of the house through a window running for his life and so wasn't able to gather together provisions because of the speed with which he departed. So we look at what happens to David next. He then goes to Gath. And another one of David's psalms are going to tie into what happens in Gath, there with King Achish. Now, if you look at the map on the screen, I tried to put a little star where a lot of this is taking place just north of Jerusalem. Now, when he goes to Gath, that's going to be off to the west a little bit, and it's actually pictured on the map. I don't know how well you can see it. After he goes to Gath, he is then going to go to the cave of Adullam, and there he's going to gather together his army. So you see what he's doing systematically. He's getting advice from a mentor who speaks for God. He's getting advice for God. He's getting food and supplies, and he's gathering an army. Because things have gone to a point now that he understands he's got to do something or he's going to lose his life. He then goes to Moab, or Mizpah, which is a region or a city controlled by the Moabites, and he asks the king to take care of his mom and dad. Now, why in the world would he go to Moab? Well, first of all, that's a natural enemy of King Saul. All right. So when this king's after you, if you want help, odds are you want to go to the one who's his enemy. But you also have to remember that David's grandmother, Ruth, is a Moabite. He's just going back to his grandmother's family and saying, "Well, y'all take care of my wife and or my mom and dad, you know, because I don't know what's going to happen to me right now." And so again, you see what he's trying to do? He's trying to put everything in place, make sure his family's safe, make sure that he's going to be okay and he can survive, because he doesn't know what is coming. And finally, he ends up in the forest of Hereth, and you can see that there in chapter 22 and verse 5. The events that really tie in to what David says in the beginning of Psalm 52 are found here in 1 Samuel 22. Because while David is in the forest, the scene then moves back to Gibeah, where Saul is gathered together with his leading soldiers, his cabinet, if you will. And as he's got his leading soldiers around me, he's basically feeling sorry for himself. And he says, you know, basically everybody's against me. Nobody told me that my own son had made a covenant with my enemy. My enemy's on the run, etc. And so he's just feeling sorry for himself and basically wants to know why nobody's telling him anything. All this stuff is going on behind his back. His son agrees to help the one he's trying to kill, and nobody tells me anything. Well, present there is a man by the name of Doeg the Edomite. When we were looking at the events that took place in Nob when he went to the tabernacle there, the text says that Doeg was present when David came to get the bread, to get the sword, and to get advice from God. So this same Doeg, he's described as the chief shepherd, and some say that can be a metaphorical or symbolic thing. Chief shepherds or chief of shepherds was used for people in different leading roles in the political arena in the ancient world, so it may not literally mean that he is a chief shepherd, but just that he is a chief and a leader among the people. But it also can mean that he's literally a chief of shepherds, which is ironic that the man who is helping Saul to catch David, who lived his life as a shepherd, would be in fact a chief of shepherds. Doeg happens to be there when Saul says, "Why doesn't anybody tell me anything?" And Doeg has known this for a while. Sometimes there are people, you know, when you get a little dirt on somebody, there are folks who say, "I'm going to hang on to this. Someday I'm going to want to twist somebody's arm. Someday I'm going to need a favor. So I'm just going to hang on to this little tidbit of dirt or information I've got on somebody. And when an opportunity or a door opens where it can help me, boom, I'll have it. So I'll just store away this little treasure." In other words, he doesn't go straight to Saul. He really, I don't think, cares anything about Saul or David. He's just holding on to the information because he cares about Doeg. And so basically what he says is, "Hey, I've seen David. You know, the other day I was over there at the tabernacle and David came to see Ahimelech." Well, immediately Saul is furious. So Saul brings in Ahimelech, brings an entourage with him, the other priests and so forth, and he says, "Basically, why are you plotting against me by helping David who is fleeing from me?" Now remember, Ahimelech knows nothing of what's happened. David actually intentionally lied to him so he wouldn't know what was going on. And so in all honesty and integrity, he looks at Saul and says, "What are you talking about? David comes to talk to me all the time. And why should that bother you? Nobody in this kingdom loves you more than David does. He's one of your most faithful followers. He's one of the commanders of your army. What's the problem?" But Saul is so driven by arrogance and rage and self-centeredness that he doesn't even see the sincerity and truth in the eyes of the priest. And he says, "You will die today, you and all yours." And so he turns to the men standing nearby and says, "Kill them all." Well, the soldiers standing by are looking at, "You want us to kill the priests? Are you kidding? You want us to kill these men who devoted their lives to serving God?" And his fellow soldiers refuse to do it. But then Saul turns to Doeg and says, "All right, then you kill them." Now remember, Doeg doesn't care about anybody but himself. And so Doeg says, "Sure, it's a chance to advance myself in the eyes of Saul." And so he kills Ahimelech, he kills 85 other priests, and then attacks and wipes out the village of Nob, kills men, women, and children. Now, as you think about that story, I want the horror of that to descend upon you. You know, this is the time in which we in this nation, I won't say we, but the nation as a whole becomes infatuated with horror. Okay? This is what some call Halloween week. All right? So every night when you turn on your television, what are you going to see? Horror. Now, folks, you didn't have to have a horror movie to see it. Just watch the evening news. But if you want to see real horror, what I've tried to quickly describe is real horror. Men who are just trying to serve God are brutally killed along with their wives and their children. David, when all of these people are killed, Abiathar, one son of Ahimelech, lives. And so he runs to David and tells David what happened. And David says, "You know, I saw Doeg there that day, and I knew he would say something. This is all my fault." And so he feels the overwhelming guilt and pain of his unwittingly causing the death of Abiathar's father and the death of all of those priests. And with all of that pain and that hurt weighing down upon him, I think we get the message of Psalm 52. As we look at this song, I think it talks about the power of the tongue, the power of trust, placed sometimes in wrong places, and the power of thanks. So let's just hit a few highlights and this lesson will be yours. Feel David's emotions as he says, "Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man? The loving kindness of God endures all day long. Your tongue devises destruction. Like a sharp razor, O worker of deceit, you love evil more than good, falsehood more than speaking what is right. You love all words that devour, O deceitful tongue." It is possible that in part of this he's talking about Saul, but the primary focus of this is Doeg. Remember what Doeg has done. With his tongue and with his actions, he has brought about the death of God's priests. And as David reflects on that, his emotions are just erupting from his heart. He says, "Oh, you deceitful tongue." And it's interesting how he describes him. He describes him in terms of his tongue. Because what was it that started all this bloody death and rampage? It was a tongue that was loose. It was a tongue that spoke which should not have been spoken. And he says, "You devise destruction." The word destruction is actually in the plural form. The idea is you devise many destructions. You want to destroy all that you can. That is your mission in life. He said, "You're like a sharp razor, a worker of deceit." Washington Irving once said that the tongue, a sharp tongue, is the only edged instrument that grows sharper with use instead of duller with use. Okay, don't you think about a sword or anything else, the more you use it, the duller it gets. His point was the tongue gets sharper. And so he pictures his tongue as like a sharp sword or a knife, cutting and hacking and tearing lives and hearts apart. And he tells us why he's that way. In other words, why is it that he lies, that he shares information that shouldn't have been shared and cuts people? He says because his heart is wrong. Because he loves evil more than good. He loves deceit and falsehood more than truth. And we're reminded of the emphasis of the teaching of Jesus, that our actions flow out of the thoughts of our heart. And if our hearts are wrong, if our hearts are impure, if our hearts are self or evil-centered, then our actions will follow. And our words will follow. Now I want you to notice something he does here. At the end of verse 3, and then again at the end of verse 5 he's going to do it, he has this word Selah. There is some discussion on what this means, but the common understanding of that I keep coming across is that in the music it was a pause. And that often it is strategically placed in a psalm. It's designed that in the middle of the psalm or the song, you would place these little statements that say pause, And what that was done for was to allow what had just been said to sink in. So as he speaks, he says, "You love evil more than good, falsehood more than speaking what is right." Pause. And let that wash over you and work deep into the recesses of our heart and mind. And then he picks up, "You love words that devour, O deceitful tongue." And then he's going, and so I want us to see the power of the tongue. I want to see the power of the tongue to destroy lives. I'm reminded of James chapter 3, where James talks about the power of the tongue. In fact, James talks about the tongue a lot in the book of James. In chapter 1, he's going to say, be swift to hear and slow to speak and slow to wrath. But in chapter 3, he's going to spend almost the whole chapter talking about the dangers of the tongue. And he pictures it not only as a fire, but a fire literally that is ignited by hell itself. And he says, we can tame all manner of beasts in the field, but we don't tame the tongue. And he talks about the absurdity of praising God with the tongue and then turning around and speaking evil of God's people who are made in God's image. And he says, these things ought not to be so. We find if, for example, if we look over in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 20 and 21, Paul is talking about things that he is afraid he will have to mourn about. Impure and unholy things going on among the Corinthians that they've not repented of. And he's afraid that when he comes to see them in person, he will have to mourn over what he sees in their lives and their actions. And as he makes a list of the things he's afraid he'll have to mourn about, these impure and unholy things, he mentions slander and gossip. I'm reminded of Revelation 21:8 when it talks about those who will experience the lake of fire, the second death. Among those listed, it mentions those who are liars. In other words, the story of Doeg and the story of the psalm of the terrible tongue that's found in Psalm 52 reminds us of the dangers of the tongue. But that's the same message we see in the New Testament. There are few things that are more dangerous, wicked, and horrible than the tongue. With the tongue, we destroy people's reputations. With the tongue, we tear families apart. With the tongue, we hurt the Lord's church by saying hurtful and negative things to neighbors and friends and publicly in the community. The tongue can destroy years of good work, which will take years to build back, and sometimes it never can be rebuilt again. And so with this graphic image in our mind, I hope the next time we're tempted to say something that might be wrong, I hope we'll see a village full of dead priests and their wives and their children lying dead on the ground around them. Because that's what a loose tongue does. In verse 5 he says, "But God will break down forever. He will snatch you up and tear you away from your tent and uproot you from the land of the living." And then he's got another pause. Pause. Think about this. He says, "The righteous will see and fear and will laugh at him, saying, 'Behold the man who would not make God his refuge, but trusted in the abundance of his riches. He was strong in his evil desire.'" And so what he's going to do is he contrasts there the one who trusts in God with the one who trusts in the abundance of his riches. And so self-centeredness and the desire to get wealth and power were underlying the actions of Doeg. And so he says, as you feel the horror of what he's done and the hopelessness of what he's done, he says, even as I think about his evil, I also think about the day when he will come down. And he uses four images here. He'll be broken down like a house which is dismantled. He will be snatched up like a coal pulled from the fire and grows cold. He will be torn away from his tent and made a homeless person. He will be uprooted from the land of the living like a tree pulled from the ground and dies because it has no nourishment, it has no water. He says that is what's coming to those who trust in themselves, who trust in riches and wealth and power. And on the other side, he pictures God's people, the same people who in this story are looking on the devastation of an entire village. And he transports them to the future through his psalm and says, "I want you to remember a day when you're looking at the same carnage, but this time it won't be the carnage of good people hurt by Doeg, but you'll be looking at the carnage of people like Doeg. And with a smile, you might say, look at what happens to people who trust in riches instead of God. And then the power of thanks in verse 8, but as for me, I'm like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the loving kindness of God forever and ever. I will give you thanks forever because you have done it. I will wait on your name, for it is good in the presence of your godly ones. Having just described those who trust in self and power and use their tongue for their own glory, having described them as being uprooted from the land of the living, he carries on that tree analogy and says that instead he is going to be like an olive tree. An olive tree can literally grow for hundreds of years. And not only do they grow hundreds of years, but they are extremely productive in helping people. For example, during its healthy years, an olive tree can produce up to 6 gallons of oil, olive oil a year or in a season. So the point is, just like a tree that is persistent and productive, so will I be, because I, instead of using my tongue to destroy, I will use my tongue to praise God. Instead of trusting in self and riches, I will trust in God. And he says, I'm not only like this durable tree, but I'm like a durable tree that gets to be in the presence of God forever. And I want you to remember, as he talks about being in the house of God, remember this whole event started because he just wanted to be in the house of God. He went to the house of God to talk to God about what to do. And because he did that, all these people have died. And he said, I want to be with the Lord. And so though I've had to flee from the house of God now, I envision a day when, like a tree that lives for hundreds of years, I shall be planted in the presence of God to be unmoved by Saul or Doeg or what evil forces walk upon the earth. And he says, I will give you thanks forever and I'll wait on your name. It's interesting that if you go back to the beginning of this psalm, as he's talking about Doeg, in verse 1 he says, but you boast in evil. The word for boast there is a word that comes from the root Hebrew word for praise. And so in other words, he begins the psalm by saying, you, O man who uses your tongue for terrible things, you live life to praise yourself. But he ends the psalm by saying, I will be God's man and I will use my tongue to not praise myself, but to praise and thank my God. Would you take out your songbooks and turn to the hymn of encouragement? My understanding is the phrase, loose lips sink ships. It's one of the phrases that came out of World War II. A great deal of emphasis was put in places like America or England on being careful what you said or what you talked about. Because, for example, in England, the battle literally came to them. And so because the bombs were falling in their own cities and troops were moving in their own cities, sometimes they witnessed troop movements and folks who weren't even in the military knew things. And so one of the things they stressed is you don't talk about what you know. Keep it to yourself. Because if you talk, there are German spies among us. They may find the information, and American, our Allied soldiers, English soldiers may die because of loose lips. How many people have died because of our loose lips? Oh, maybe they haven't died literally, but maybe they're struggling physically. Maybe they're struggling spiritually. Maybe they're struggling emotionally because of something we said that should have been kept to ourselves. How much damage has been done to the Lord's church because of negative things we said about a congregation or about our congregation or about the Lord's church in public? I want us to realize that loose lips break hearts, break lives, and they do untold damage to the Lord's church. There are things that we need to talk about sometimes. There are things that need to be discussed. And sometimes there are tough things to discuss. Sometimes things need to be confronted. But there's a right way to do it, and there's a wrong way to do it. The New Testament pattern is when the right way is to go and deal with it in private. The wrong way is to deal with it in public. But that tends to be what we do. And often instead of going to each other, we go to everybody else. The challenge of this story is to take a long, hard look at what we say and where we say it. But the one thing that also should come out of this psalm is that even though there are evil people like Doeg in the world, in the second verse he says, "But the Lord and His loving kindness endures forever." You will be hurt in your life by people like Doeg. But there is a day coming when God will take you to a place where people cannot hurt you anymore. And it is my prayer, if you've never accepted that Lord as the Lord of your life, if you believe with all of your heart that Jesus Christ is the Son of the living God and that He died for your sins, it is my prayer that you will acknowledge the reality of all of us. We are sinners. You'll confess your faith in Jesus and be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins, to become a part of the God whose loving kindness endures forever. For those of us who are Christians, if we need to apologize to somebody, let's apologize. If we need to forgive somebody, let's forgive. And if we need to seek God's forgiveness, then let's do it right now as we stand and sing.